right, everybody, we are back with the Smells Like Cinematic podcast, which is a side component of my Smells Like Infinite Sadness podcast, where we discuss the best in alternative music from the 80s and 90s to present day, but we also like to discuss the best in classic film, or bad film, or quirky film, weird film, whatever kind of cult classic film I can think of from all time, basically. And today we're going to be discussing, in honor of upcoming Halloween, the best horror films of all time. With me, I've got my friend Jack Summersby, and we are both hardcore horror movie fans, but we're fairly picky, and we've narrowed it down to our personal top tens. We've got three overlappers, so we're going to work our way down to what we think is the best horror film of all time. And I will preface this by saying I realize that when you say the best horror film, of course, it's always objective, subjective, however you want to look at it. There are some omissions here. You may be like, why didn't you include this film? And some of it's personal taste. Some of it's wanting to give some exposure to other films that maybe don't get as much love as some of the best known classics. So we're trying to make it interesting here. And yeah, so Jack, which one do you want to kick it off with?
Oh, well, first, thanks for Smells Like Infinite Sadness for having me. And on my end, it's also being brought to you by Patrick's Pipe. let's see here. Well, let's start at number 10 is a 1984 zombie movie called Mutant. It was originally called Night Shadows. It takes place in a small southern town where this it's revealed this company, this conglomerate, is actually taking nuclear waste or toxic waste and actually, instead of disposing it properly, is basically putting it into the ground. And it affects the people mostly through water. And the first half of the film, it's really good. There's a lot of suggestiveness. It's real big on atmosphere. You don't know what's quite causing it. And these two vacationing brothers, one of them played by one of our favorites, the old-time intense Wings Hauser, they're brothers. They get in the car wreck. They're stranded in this town, and some very strange happenings go on. You don't really see the zombies until they're fast moving. You don't really see them until about the last third of the movie. But up until then, it's very sustained. One of the best musical scores of all time in a horror movie is done by Richard Band. And it's this creepy crawly from the get-go. And what really sells the picture is it's got believable three-dimensional characters in the cast. And they really take you into the movie. These aren't just cardboard cutouts. They're if you have a stake in the characters, you're going to have a stake in the movie. So that's my number 10 pick. It's got a beautiful Blu-ray transfer from Code Red. They don't put out Blu-rays anymore, but and John Bud Cardos took over the directing chores. And he was a former stuntman and does an absolutely first-rate job. He also took over the direction for a 1979 movie called The Dark, another horror movie. So he shows very good technique in the film, and that's my number 10. I first saw it in 1984, or 85 it came on video, and I still love it.
He also did the infamous Kingdom of the Spiders with William Shatner, which is a true campy delight. I still enjoy watching that whenever I see it on TV. It's so over the top. A whole town overrun by tarantulas, and Shatner's at his scenery chewing finest. So I had to throw that one in there.
I forgot about that. Yeah. That's true. They did a difficult thing. These tarantulas are rather small, and he managed to make them frightening. So yeah, it's a shame we haven't got more films from him, but yeah, he's definitely one of my favorite horror directors. And you're number 10?
I'm going to go with House of the Devil. It's the most recent film that's on this list. And I chose it because I feel like, even though it's slowly building a cult following, it's a lot of film people don't know about. I believe it came out in 2007. I could be wrong about that. It's directed by Ty West, who is most recently known. He's finally getting some recognition for his X and Pearl films, which came out the past couple of years, which are both solid. kind of slasher homages. And House of the Devil is really the first, I think, that I can remember of, you know, it's like a whole subgenre now of these 80s retro horror films set in the 80s with the 80s soundtracks. But House of the Devil really feels like it was shot like in the late 70s, early 80s. It's got that exact feel. They shot it on 16 millimeter so that it looks like it. It's got the retro synth score. The opening soundtrack intro sounds almost like the Cars song from Fast Times, like Ridgemont High. But it's instrumental. But it's just a really cool occult film that deals with satanic panic. That was a big deal for us when we were kids. Everybody was all freaked out about satanic cults. And of course, they still are, ridiculously. But it's just a really cool low-key horror film about a woman who gets takes a job babysitting during a lunar eclipse, and unbeknownst to her, the people she's babysitting for may or may not have a child. They may have somebody else, and they may be involved with Satan, and it may involve her. She may be a central figure in their scheme. And it stars Jocelyn Donahue, does a really solid performance as the lead role. It's also got one of our favorites, Tom Noonan, who plays the creepy guy who is who hires her for the babysitting role. And his wife is Mary Warrenov, who people may remember from films like Edie Raoul or Night of the Comet, things like that. So it's got some great, including them, it's also got Dee Wallace Stone, who plays a realtor. So it's got a lot of nice, throwbacks to different people from the 80s and 70s. And I think it's just a really solid film. I like it because it's got lots of quiet moments. It's not one of these modern films where it's just like music, scare. It really takes its time. And some people may think it's too slow, but personally, I think it's part of its charm. And I think House of the Devil deserves to be in, you know, seen as a modern day classic. And yeah, so that's definitely, that's my pick.
Well, for our listeners who don't know, Tom Noonan played the original, he played the Tooth Fairy in the first Hannibal Lecter movie called Manhunter. In that, before Ralph Fiennes, there was Tom Noonan. And Dee Wallace Stone played the heroine in the not bad 1983 Stephen King adaptation, Cujo, about the killer St. Bernard.
Mm-hmm. And The Howling and E.T. So she definitely, she definitely has a, knack for being in some cult classic horror films and of course one of the biggest science fiction films ever made. So that would be my
The E.T. Yeah,
but I definitely think she gives a nice little touch of authenticity to it, and it's just got some really great moments. Like it ends on a freeze frame, like so many films back then did, and like it's just I think it's a special movie. I always watch it every Halloween. And whenever anybody asks me, what's a modern horror film that you like, I go, it's not the newest film, but it's still, you know, it definitely is. I just really enjoy it. I think it's just a really, really fun movie. And so, so that's my number 10, 2009. I will clarify 2009. Anyways. So what's next on your list?
Number nine, it's called Dead and Buried from 1981. It was co-written by Dan O'Bannon, who co-wrote Alien. This is another film. It takes place in a sleepy town, only it's a Northern California sleepy town, and the sheriff, played by James Ferrantino. It's a very serene town, and yet photography, the opening credits, they show you these shots of it. I mean, it looks like so peaceful, yet it's got really a nerving layer to it where you just sense there's something evil amongst it. And it turns out these murders start happening, vicious murderers, and they're made to look like accidents. And the more Ferrantino digs into it, he finds that the dead are coming back to life. And it turns out it's this the mortician is played by this elderly actor named Jack Albertson. He played the father in the original Willy Wonka. And they cast him as this black magic Satanist of a mortician who basically he's turned the town into his own little playing ground. Everybody who dies, he resurrects. If he doesn't have enough dead people, he gets his people, kill them, just so he can perform the magic of making them look real again. And of course, they have these homicidal tendencies. It's a really wonderful picture. It's directed by Gary Sherman, who also did, was it Vice Squad? I also did Poltergeist 2. So, it's a very good film. Again, it's set in a small town. It's got this really a sense of dailiness to it that makes the place really feel real. And the cinematographer, Stephen Poster, shot it in this really tricky, soft focus, yet he used a lot of natural light. So it's a very interestingly shot picture. A lot of it's done in darkness. And it has a wonderful music score, too. So that's my number 9 pick, Dead and Buried.
Yeah, that's a good one. And they actually showed that recently on Joe Bob on Shudder, and he has some interesting tidbits about it. But I always, what I like about that film too, it kind of has that atmosphere, kind of reminds me of The Fog a little bit, and you know, finding the small California town to shoot it in, coastal town, and definitely some good atmosphere. But yeah, we always had a good chuckle about Jack Albertson's face when he gets shot with something happens to him and he makes a pretty good facial expression. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, yeah, it's called we rewound that 1,000 times, and it sucks though, because see, if it wasn't for you, I probably wouldn't have found it funny. So every time I watch the damn film, I'm taken out of it because of you. I never thought it was funny until I saw it with you, so you kind of ruined it for me. Oh my god.
I can't help it. It struck me funny. But, okay, well.
And your number 9 film which is it?
We're going to go with Carnival of Souls, which is a film that you've got a few kicks out of over the years. Carnival of Souls is a 60s film directed by Herc Hervey, who was a industrial films guy. He made like a lot of like industrial tool video, you know, films and how to, you know, like work ethic films and things, basically like instructional films, driver's ed kind of stuff. He had a whole cottage industry of that he did in Kansas. And one time he got this kind of crazy idea of let's make a horror film, but I want to make it like almost like a Jean Cocteau kind of a French surrealist kind of a film. And he found these local actors. It's a very amateurish film, definitely not polished, not professional, but it's got something to it, some very odd quality to it. I know that it was influential to both George Romero for Night of the Living Dead and for David Lynch, who often I've heard he was taken with it. But it's basically about a woman played by Candace Hillegloss who all of a sudden finds that she's not really fitting into society anymore. She's having these strange visions where she feels separate from humanity, and she starts seeing this ghostly figure who kind of follows her. And I believe the film was loosely based off the Hitchhiker episode from Twilight Zone. So that's part of its genesis. There's all sorts of like, could be this, could have been influenced by this. It's kind of just mysterious, but basically the more you watch the film, the more you realize where it's going. It's not, especially there's been a dozen films that have been released since Carnival of Souls that have borrowed the same idea.
Jacob's Ladder
definitely borrow from it. But it's a really enjoyable movie, but it's also got some goofy moments because you are using amateur actors who look into the camera or they stammer. And there's a woman who plays this boarding house owner who she's like, "Oh, ain't that a kick in the head?" Or "You can use all the hot water that you like." And just weird stuff like that. But
yeah, people talk too loud in the film.
Yeah, definitely talk too loud. The actress, the lead actress, is really strange. But they film a lot of the scenes at this old Salt Lake Pavilion, which was in Kansas, it was in Salt Lake City, I think. It's either in Utah,
yeah,
Kansas.
It was.
Yeah,
and right outside it.
And so it's this really amazing looking, like kind of Russian spires and stuff. It's a really cool building. And it really gives the atmosphere, a lot of atmosphere to it. And I just think it's a really, really enjoyable film. It's definitely one that has a cult following over the years. And yeah, it's a Carnival of Souls. I'll toss that one into the mix.
Yeah, that's a fine. It didn't make my top 10, but I do enjoy watching it. What's interesting is for some, this was his first feature film, Herc Harvey. Like you said, he did Industrial Training Grounds. In fact, I looked at IMDb. He actually won 4 awards for this industrial training video called Shake Hands with Danger. It was about how to operate heavy machinery. But it was shot in Lawrence, Kansas. What's amazing anywhere, like for a guy with his background, is how visually the film is very well made. I mean, the images just stay with you. He has a very good eye for composition. The black and white photography is absolutely gorgeous, especially when you watch it on the Criterion disc.
Yes.
It's just amazing. I heard Scorsese was very impressed by it too. In fact, I think he was one of the ones who got it reissued back in 89. He liked it so much. So overall, it's a very interesting picture. I remember that womanizing one of the rumors of the guys renting a room in the house. I remember you told me he reminded you a lot of our friend Jason's dad. I think he did. But it's a beautiful film to watch. I can just say that you've never seen anything quite like it in your life. And yeah, it does borrow that thing. I say it did get that from that Twilight Zone episode. But yeah, it's a very good pick. Well, that's black and white. So let's go to my number 8. This is a black and white. This is the original Invisible Man from 1933. It was from the H.G. Wells novel, and it still holds up today. You look at some of the special effects and you're like, my gosh. You know, where you're seeing footsteps, yet you don't see the person making them. You're seeing objects move, but you don't see the person moving them. And so from back then, it was, it's still a potent picture to me. It's a very psychological movie, because the scientist, after he infects himself with his own invention of being invisible, he eventually grows steadily mad and megalomaniacal, kind of like Trump. And it's set in a small village. And I just watched it the other day, and like I said, for those who haven't seen it, there's Frankenstein, there's the Wolfman that came out that time. My pick is The Invisible Man.
And that is a very solid film. It's still very entertaining. Did you happen to see the remake that came out a few years ago?
You mean the one with the feminized one?
Yes.
Yeah, I did. I just don't think it's even in the same ballpark. I mean, it's just not even the same kind of film. No, I watched it. I thought it was very the remake I thought was disturbing on these on a very certain level was disturbing. So I enjoyed watching it, but yeah, it can't hold a candle to the original.
No, but it did have a few moments that I was actually kind of impressed by. I wasn't expecting much from it because I don't really care for that director, but I thought it has had some good jolts in there. But yeah, definitely the original is certainly superior. And I actually watched it for the first time in a long time about 5 years ago, and I was like really kind of surprised how well it still holds up. So definitely a solid pick. And I'm going to go now with what I think is possibly the weirdest horror film ever made, or at least one of them, and that is the original 1970s The Wicker Man. The Wicker Man may be the only Christian fable, pagan warning, folk horror musical that has ever existed. I don't know if I've ever seen any film quite like it. It's just relentlessly odd. It was released in the early 70s. It stars Edward Woodward, who's best known as the main guy from the original Equalizer show. He plays this kind of high and mighty fundamentalist Christian cop who thinks everybody's going to hell, and he wants to live this virtuous life. And he goes to this island, this remote island, coastal English island, to try to find this girl, Rowan Morrison, who has gone missing. And the parents don't know where she's at. And he shows up this island, and everybody's acting weird. He's getting the runaround. He sees all this kind of weird pagan sexual stuff going on. Everybody's playing these weird folk tunes everywhere. And he gets really
creepy.
Yeah, he gets really kind of seduced by this one bar maiden character, Britt Eklund, who has this scene where she's singing a song in the nude, which is truly odd.
Babe.
Yeah, yeah, she was very attractive. And it also features Christopher Lee, who plays Lord Summer Isle. He plays the main villain in the show. But, you know, most of the film is people saying, no, you're overreacting. You're just don't realize that we just do things our own way, but we're fine. And you just need to loosen up. And he's like, no, you people are sinners and I'm going to find out what's going on. I'm going to find this girl. Then you get the actual reveal of what's really happening. And it's really a horrific. It's got one of the most chilling twists and endings, I think, to any film. Like it's rough.
It's devastating.
And I don't want to give too much away for this. I haven't seen it, and we're trying to avoid spoilers here as much as we can. But definitely, if you want to see a film that will not only find it bizarre, but definitely stick with you, you'll never forget The Wicker Man. And that's not even putting into account the horrifically terrible remake of The Wicker Man they made in the early 2000s with Nicolas Cage, which is also worth watching just because it's so bad is good. Just because if you want some true laughs, I mean, Nicolas Cage screaming about the bees while he's getting attacked by bees is definitely worth a watch, if only once. But nothing holds a candle to the original Wicker Man, in my personal opinion.
You'll never look at a bonfire the same way again.
No.
No, I haven't. Well, this is, it was 1973, and this was, I can't remember I don't think this was from a major studio. In fact, I know it wasn't, because this was kind of something that, I don't know I can't remember if it was made, but I don't know if it got a widespread release or not. I didn't check on that. It's wonderful. This little village where all this is taking place seems so innocent, and yet the director, I think his last name is Hardy, does a good job of putting some. Almost every scene has something kind of off in it. You can't quite put your finger on it, and it's kind of neat that way. Because when it goes to the next scene, you go, "Damn it! What was in that last scene that I should have picked up on it?" It's very clever. You don't really pick up, and then at the end, it all comes, it all makes sense. Every piece of the puzzle comes together. And and the key to the film is Edward Woodward's performance. Always a wonderful actor. Even, I know he did the TV series, he did some feature films, not nearly enough, but he worked with Fred Skepsey, he worked with Bruce Beresford and that Bible episode. Yeah, he's wonderful. He's in practically every scene, and we're with him every step of the way. You really grow to care about this guy, and he definitely does. He definitely makes a better protagonist than Nicolas Cage. So, Wicker Man, it is, I read recently, it did get a 4K release. So, our listeners, there's DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. It's out on those formats. I don't know if it's streaming, but it's definitely worth looking out for. And my number seven is, David Cronenberg has done a lot of interesting films, very eccentric, very eclectic horror films, and he's made quite a few. And the one that keeps coming back to me time and time again, there's one I always say, if I had to be on a deserted island and I was only given one film of each director to watch for the rest of my years in the island, which one I watch? I would say The Dead Zone's a better picture. In fact, it was my pick for number one, 1983. But at that same year, he had two films released, and the other was Videodrome, starring James Woods as this young president of a small Canadian cable channel that offers its viewers everything from hardcore violence to softcore pornography. And he comes across a test pattern, kind of a pirated movie, but he can only see like 60 seconds at a time because it's being broadcast maybe out of Malaysia, maybe somewhere. It's very fuzzy, but it's just in the show of torture and murder. The camera doesn't move. You see these women and men being electrocuted, being mutilated and all this stuff. Well, it turns out that it's when you watch this, it creates a tumor in your head. And Cronenberg, as you know, Michael, is real, has always been fixated on the human body. And Max Wren, James Woods' character, eventually finds himself eventually almost interchangeable with the technology he's surrounding himself with. So it's a very, I love the picture. It's just so full of ideas. It's not entirely even James Woods admits in the commentary that they were making up, they didn't have an ending when they started the film, and about two-thirds of the way, they still didn't have an ending for the film. So they came up with something, and I don't know if it makes a whole lot of sense, but you don't really care. It's a wonderful picture. James Woods, my gosh, he's his usual outstanding self. People tend to forget that he's very funny. He's a very good light comedian. He carries the film, and the special effects were done by Rick Baker, who did American Werewolf in London. So it's a wonderful picture, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, Videodrome is definitely weird and Cronenbergian. I think it also, I don't know, it feels to me kind of weirdly prophetic in some ways, maybe just on enjoying cruelty as entertainment in kind of our reality TV era, maybe something to that. But definitely it also has that quintessential Canadian oddness that is Cronenberg. I will say that I've actually seen two of his son's recent films. I forget the first one. I did see Infinity Pool. And he did one prior to that, which is, the name is escaping me, Possessor. And both of those are very solid films. I mean, it's like you think, oh, well, he's just copying his dad going to body horror, which is true, but he's definitely given his own spin on it. And you could definitely see that his dad rubbed up on him in good ways. So if you are a Cronenberg fan, I do recommend his son's work as well. It's surprisingly good.
All right. And next up for you.
I'm going to go with Tobe Hooper's original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. This could have been higher on the list, but I've got so many great films on my list that it was, these are almost impossible to rank, but I had to get Texas Chainsaw Massacre on here because it really was revolutionary when it came out. Nobody has seen anything like it. Tobe Hooper basically made this kind of guerrilla warfare film where he got a bunch of, you know, amateur Texas actors, took him into rural Texas, made this cannibalistic horror film, and there's just something about it that is, it's, you know, I interviewed Gunnar Hansen years ago, who played Leatherface in the film. He's no longer with us, unfortunately, but I interviewed him when I was doing work for Axis, and he mentioned to me that he felt that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was almost a post-apocalyptic film, and when you watch it, it really does feel like it's in some kind of world where things are not functioning correctly. Nobody's acting normal. Everyone is stressed. There's just something not right. And if you've ever lived in Texas, as Jack and I have, and have driven through rural Texas, there are times when you're driving alone and you realize I'm cut off from society. If anybody was to pick me up, you know, drag me off and take me to some farmhouse, no one would ever know. So for Texans especially, I think Texas Chainsaw is specifically a frightening film. It's one of those films that was banned in England and declared to be too gory, but really it's not bloody at all. It's got like one scene at the beginning where you see this mutilated corpse, but besides that, there's like maybe a literal drop of blood spilt in the film, which is done in a very humorous way. And I will say Texas Chainsaw Massacre is one of those films that, for being as horrific as it is, it's actually a really funny movie. I mean, you often
Grandpa.
Yeah, you often feel sick for laughing at it. These people getting terrorized, but it is done in such a way that there is an element of comedy to it. And you know, it was filmed very cheaply. All the actors talk about the conditions being really brutal and shooting Texas heat with no air conditioning. And just the smell of, you know, butcher meat. But there's just certain scenes like Leatherface, you know, pulling that guy into that room, shutting that steel door. The sound effects, which are all, the music is all these like weird found sounds. It's not even like music. It's just like a sound collage. It just puts you on edge. And I just think the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is one of the greats, one of the best titles for a horror film. One of the first horror films that says it's based off a true story when it's really not, but then it kind of is because it's kind of loosely based on the Ed Gein murders, mm-hmm. who also will inspire another film further up the list. But yeah, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, total classic. You know, they try to make endless sequels and remakes, and none of them have been up to snuff to the original.
Now, the violent incident in the movie that gets me the most is early on. It's been a while. It's when they pick up that crazy hitchhiker who winds up being one of the cannibalistic family, mm-hmm. and he stabs him one of the people in an ankle with, is it a knife or a screwdriver or something? It's a blunt instrument, not blunt toy, but he attacks him in the van.
Yeah, he takes a straight razor and cuts Franklin's arm, and then he dabs the blood on the side of the van when he gets kicked out of the van. So like, it's almost like he marks the van so that they know where to look for later, I think was kind of what was implied. But
Okay, that's what I meant. And this is one of those pictures where you hope. If you got stuck watching it on VHS, that wouldn't be a bad thing because it's got that look to it. And I go, you really don't want, I can't imagine this in 4K or if it's in, I know it's been released in 4K, but I don't want it to look too good. I think some of these 4K releases make things look a little, it makes them look fancier than the director intended. So, it's Tobe Hooper, and those who don't know, he wound up from there. He had a troubled career after that. He got replaced from that movie, The Dark, that John Bud Cardos did. He took over from Tobe Hooper. I hear Spielberg took over from Hooper on Poltergeist. He did put out something in 1976 called Eaten Alive. It was about people in a Florida motel in the small town. I'm not sure, but he is responsible for Life Force from 1985, one of the goofiest sci-fi horror films of all mm-hmm. time. It's called Space Vampires, and it's got a fully nude female vampire and practically indestructible. So he had a real good budget there. Texas Chainsaw, of course, is very low budget. Life Force had a good, and the year before that, he did another film for Canon Pictures. It was the remake of Invasion from Mars.
Oh yeah,
from 1953. And I thought a lot of people didn't like it. I did, and he shot it in widescreen as he did Life Force, and visually it's a very interesting picture. So Texas Chainsaw, for those who haven't seen, please don't watch the stupid remake. It's just sacrilege to watch.
Well, especially the one they released last year or the year before on Netflix, which is even worse than the first remake. It's absolutely god awful. I mean, truly, just the worst kind of, yeah, don't watch it.
There were some dark comic moments in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which
yes.
Super Oslo did.
Yes.
They were intentional laughs.
Yeah, it's a much more campy movie, but it does have its moments. I remember taking a class at Texas Wesleyan where they had the screenwriter for Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 come in and talk to our class, and someone asked what was his favorite line of dialogue that he ever wrote. And the guy said, "Lick my plate, dog dick." And there was this really religious couple that were taking the class together, and they both walked out. They both stormed out saying this was just too offensive for them to listen to. Classic, classic. So, yes.
Well, your last two picks both came out in 1973, I believe. Wicker Man and Matt Chainsaw came out in 73. So back then, 73, that was a... And that people weren't prepared for this kind of grisly material. My next pick, now we've had our share of comic book movies. Me, I'm kind of like Scorsese. I don't like these superhero movies. I don't like the comic book. I'm just so sick of them. They all lined up alike. They don't have it. They're all marketed where there's no individuality to them. They just follow a pattern, and they're just so impersonal. Now, my pick for the best comic book movie ever made came out in 1982. It was from George A. Romero, and he's on my list twice. I'll tell you the other film when we get to it, but this is 1982's Creepshow, and it was based on five stories by horror author Stephen King. And Romero does a wonderful job of convincing you you're inside a comic book. The garish lighting, the odd camera angles. It's a darkly comic picture. There's comedy in each of the five episodes. The first one, of course, is Father's Day, about this demented old man who still wants his Father's Day cake, even though he's dead in the ground. There is number two, Stephen King plays a hillbilly who comes across a small meteor that lands in his yard, and foolishly touches the thing, and there's a lot of havoc after that. There's the crate where a centuries-old creature is somehow still living, buried in this crypt under the stairwell at university. Fourth one, Ted Danson is a Leslie Nielsen plays a bad guy who he's quite angry that Ted Danson is having an affair with his wife and takes him to the beach, but not quite in the way that you would want to be taken to the beach. It was very there's a lot of things on there's a lot of things on televisions in the segment, and this is before we had HDTV. So you see a TV out in the sand with cables being supplied by this Jeep, and you're like, oh, back then it was like, oh my God, that's incredible. And number five is this vicious billionaire who's a what do you call it when you're afraid of bugs? He's definitely afraid of bugs. He's got this $3,200 supposedly pest-free apartment, and let's just say if you think you've seen, you get, if you're you freaked out that the side of one cockroach, you ain't seen nothing yet over here. It's a wonderful picture. I saw my dad got his tickets to see it, so I saw it when it was 12, and when these cockroaches come out of someone's body, it just literally stopped my heart. I was so utterly afraid. But this is what you call a comedy chiller, and a lot of films get this wrong, because for a comedy chiller to work, you have to have 50% scares, 50% humor, and the tone has to be there right in the middle. If you veer off on either side, it kind of throws it off, and Romero just does a wonderful job of convincing us, again, that we're in a comic book. It's a dark comic book. This is, I think, before graphic novels really became a thing. I think, don't you? I mean, I'm sure some of these authors were inspired by Creepshow. So that's number six on my list.
Yeah, and Creepshow is one of those, because back when that film came out, I was a very avid comic book reader, and I always liked to read the comic book adaptations, sometimes even before I saw the movie. And there was a Creepshow comic that covered all the different stories, and it was done so perfectly. It really showed you how perfectly they capture the comic book aspect of the film, because it transfers so beautifully to the comic issue. But then I saw the movie and always have loved it. I love how they actually make comic book panels for, you know, the overlay on top of the shots.
Yeah.
With the thought dialogues and stuff. You get to have wonderful moments like Ed Harris doing this terrible 80s dance during the Father's Day segment. You've got Hal Holbrook and Fritz Weaver.
Oh, Adrian Barbeau. Yeah.
Adrian Barbeau and the crate, who are all just totally hamming it up to, you know, to ridiculous degrees. And the acting is so over the top, but it's perfect for what they're going for. You know, Ted Danson and Leslie Nielsen working together, and the one you mentioned about the TV on the beach, and then Stephen King, who gave his acting debut And what was the name of that episode? The one where he was with the meteorite? Jody,
something Jody Verrill.
Yeah. And I think
the strange or something death of Jody Verrill.
And I think that Stephen King really steals the movie because he is hilarious as this guy who's totally goofy and he gets this moss off the meteorite that's growing on him like a fungus. And he's like, oh, Jody Verrill, you done it now. And he's just totally like just really playing it up. And I love his performance in that. And then, of course, yes, if you're a germaphobe, if you're terrified of bugs like my wife is, the last segment is absolute nightmare fuel. It's funny. She's watched Creepshow, but she can't watch the last segment. She just fast forwards through it. She can't or she leaves the room while I watch it. She cannot watch it. So, yeah, Creepshow, definitely one of the great comic book films, definitely one of the great 80s horror films. And just, yeah, just a blast to watch. And yeah, you know, they oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was saying for the listeners out there, Shout Factory has put out a beautiful 4K transfer of it. You also get the Blu-ray struck off the same 4K master. Along with that, Shout Factory has presented it, and the DVD was just rather mediocre, but seek out the Shout Factory 4K disc. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, and they've actually made a Creepshow television series for the Shudder Network, and I keep hoping it's going to get better, but so far that I've watched it, it just doesn't have the magic. But if you go read the reviews, everybody thinks it's a great show, and I'm just baffled by it. But they just released a new season. I'll probably hate watch it just to see if it gets better, but I've really been disappointed by the Creepshow series. I was hoping it would have – I felt like the first episode – definitely did have the comic book elements, but I think they've kind of cut their budget back. So I don't see them trying as hard to capture that aspect of it. And yeah, it's just really kind of half-assed in my personal opinion, but who knows? I'll give the new season a shot and we'll see if it gets better.
Well, skip Creepshow 2. It came out 5 years later. The guy who directed it did the cinematography. Well, he's a great cinematographer, but as a director, he's all thumbs. Instead of 5 episodes, it's 3. I read where the budget got cut. They were going to have 5. They could only do 3. And Romero did the screenplay on it. One of them, called The Raft, was based on a Stephen King story. Largely, it's a waste of time, though. The third episode, called The Hitchhiker, has its moments. And I'm one of the – I like the cheesy animation in it. A lot of people trash. I kind of like it. So, all right, that's Creepshow. And next up for you?
Next up for me, this is one where I debated putting it higher on the list once again, but, you know, all these films for me are classics, so it's hard to rank them. So I'm going to go with Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. It's often seen as the proto-slasher, the one that basically put the template of the lone killer stalking women. And it's Hitchcock really at his finest. You know, he went from making these really big Technicolor suspense films. And for this film, he decided, well, I'm going to try something different. And he used the film crew that worked on his television series, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and went from Technicolor going back to black and white and made a very cheap adaptation of a Robert Bloch novel of the same name, but he changed some key aspects of it. And it's just, you know, he's called the master of suspense, and Psycho is a perfect example of why. It's also got one of the great shocker. And I feel like in this case, I can talk about this film, because if you haven't seen Psycho by now, just, you know, avert your ears. But, you know, it was one of the first films that decided to kill off its main character halfway through the film. You think Janet Leigh is going to be this main character who's on the lam because she stole money from her job and she wants to start a new life with her lover, because he's trying to get out of a bad marriage. And
which De Palma aped in Dress to Kill when he had the Angie Dickinson character killed early.
Mm-hmm. And which Wes Craven also copied when he made Scream with Drew Barrymore, did a very similar thing. And you know, it introduces Anthony Perkins as this hotel owner, the motel owner, the Bates Motel named Norman Bates. And Anthony Perkins is so good in this role, because he plays this guy, this kind of sensitive, soft-spoken guy who you feel sorry for. You think he's has this overbearing mother he keeps talking about, and you hear him going up to his house and talking to his mother, and this argues they have, and she berates him, and Janet Leigh's character feels sorry for him. And what you don't find out until the end is that he's harboring a terrible secret, and he's not the nice guy that you think he is, at least some of the time. And it's just a great gothic horror. The cinematography is beautiful. The music by Bernard Herrmann, it's all cellos. And it's one of the great, you know, everybody who's watched any horror or anything alive, even if they haven't seen the film, knows a shower scene with that shrieking strings. The shower scene, of course, is famous. It used, I forget how many shots. They actually made a documentary a few years ago. I think it's on Hulu. Strictly
like 68.
Yeah.
68 or something like that.
Yeah. And it's all about the shower scene and how it was constructed. Because this is back in the early 60s where you couldn't really show nudity on screen. So he cut it so quickly between all these different shots of Leigh getting stabbed that you never got a full, although if you freeze frame it, you can see some brief nudity. It's sparing, but you can find it. But he did it so quickly and so cleverly that not only do you not get a full sense of what's going on, you also get this terrible feeling of an assault, all these different angles. He used a stabbing of a watermelon to sound like the stabbing of flesh. And of course, it's got one of the great shock endings in cinema where you're like, what in the world? How did they even come up with this concept? But it was genius. And yeah, I mean, it's seen as a classic for a very good reason. Even though a lot of it's dated now, you can still see the genius behind it. And, you know, why people like John Carpenter revere it so much and were inspired, you know, when they made films. So Psycho is definitely up there for me.
Trivia thing. I heard this years ago. I don't know if it's true. I heard it was the first feature film to show a toilet.
Yes, that is true. And he was very proud of that. Hitchcock was very, very proud of that.
I was trying to recommend it to I was having a discussion with someone years ago about the film, and I said one of the canny things Hitchcock does, it's that close up before she gets to the motel. She's sleeping on the side of the road in the car. She decides to not, and this cop, you know, interrogates her, and the way Hitchcock frames it, you get a dead on shot of the cop from her point of view, and he looks so sinister. Now, mm-hmm. He's a policeman. He's a good guy, but he looks so sinister, and you think, wait a minute, this guy's going to play something late. Then you get the way Anthony Perkins is portrayed. He's a very kindly man, very appealing, very, you know, he wants to make his guests as comfortable as possible. So he comes off, the cop is the one who comes off kind of malevolent, and Perkins comes off as rather harmless. So I like the way he did that. That wonderful house. Oh my gosh, I don't know who constructed it, but it's such a showplace. I featured it in all the sequels. It came out in 1960, so this was a big thing back then. You didn't have that kind of film back then. And Hitchcock, he's done many films. This is still my favorite of his. People ask me my favorite Hitchcock, I automatically say Psycho. The sequel, the next sequel wasn't bad. It was done by Richard Franklin,
yeah,
the Australian, and that's not a bad sequel. It's actually until it turns into a slasher pick in the last third, and that's kind of disappointing. But I also like Psycho 3. I have that on Blu-ray now. Anthony Perkins only starred, reprised his role as Norman. He directed the picture, and it's a dark comedy, a black comedy, and it's really, I have it on Blu-ray. I like watching it. It's very cleverly done. There's these shots that are very neck, and there's a scene where there's a dead body in this ice machine, and the sheriff blindly, he's not looking at the ice machine, he just absently, you know, opens it up and he's chewing on munching on an ice cube, not knowing that it's an ice cube dripping with blood. So I recommend it a lot. And yeah, Psycho shows that horror film can really be terrifying without laying on the gore. The shower scene that we've talked about, there's not one shot of the knife actually penetrating flesh.
Nope.
That's out of there. So, yeah, I heard it was like 68 different cuts or something. I can't remember. So that's definitely a thing. Now, my number five, well, this is one Michael and I both agree on this. It is John Carpenter's The Thing. And I saw this. Now, our listeners out there, Michael and I was born in 1970. So are you 71 or
something?
Yeah,
71.
Okay, so I first saw it. It was 1982. I was too young to see it at the theater. I was 12, but we saw it. This is when it took a year for something to get on VHS from the movie theater. Now it's like 3 weeks. And we saw it at a slumber party. Just us guys put in The Thing. And for those who don't know, it's basically tells of a spaceship that crashed on Earth 100,000 years ago. Well, it takes place in the Antarctic, and these Norwegians have discovered this alien species. The film opens with a helicopter chasing after a Siberian husky in the middle of nowhere. It's very beautiful. You don't know what in the hell is going on. Turns out this husky is the alien basically can imitate any kind of life form it comes in contact with. It's the husky, basically it's imitated the husky. And when it gets in, it's practically destroyed the Norwegian station, and it manages to run to a U.S. substation in Antarctica with Kurt Russell playing the hero, R.J. McCready, the helicopter pilot. Well, the husky gets over there. Soon it infects the humans, and they're in an isolated setting. Very isolated in the middle of Antarctic. They can't get anyone on the radio. And basically, it gets to the point where it's 12 researchers, all men, and they don't know who to trust because the thing has infected and duplicated some of them. And it's not only physically, this is what's also interesting, is that it also blocks your subconscious. While the thing controls the human, it actually takes over the human subconscious. So even if someone's infected, they don't necessarily know they're infected. And that's an incredibly terrifying thing, knowing if you're human or if you're not. People will always talk about the special effects. This was before CGI, computer generated effects. They were all done by Rob Bottin. They're very organic. There's no computer. These are some of the most spectacular special effects, but I do disagree with a lot of the critics. A lot of the critics back then called it a freak show because of all these, but I think the special effects are justified given the subject matter. So yes, sometimes they're over the top, but I don't think it overwhelms the story. The 12 actors who play the scientists and the men at the they're completely believable. I also disagree with the other critics that you can't tell them apart, mostly because they're wearing all this winter clothing. And that's a bunch of bull. I always know. It's easy to know, whose character is what, and yeah. So I'm glad, and it was a revelation to see this in Laserdisc for the first time. I got to see it in widescreen, and I was seeing all this stuff on the sides I'd never seen before. So not only was the picture quality better from VHS, I got all this side information because, as we know, Michael, John Carpenter loves the 2.35:1 aspect ratio. So that's my pick, and how about your thoughts, Michael?
Well, the thing actually would be it's not only my favorite horror film, it's my favorite movie of all time. The Thing for me is, it's the best remake ever made. It was remade from The Thing from Another World, which was a 50s creature feature, but it really stays more closely based on the short story Who Goes There that film was also based on. It was in 1982, two films came out on the same weekend and both bombed. Both the critics said it sucked and that they were stupid and they were boring and One was too gory, one was too slow. The other film was Blade Runner. And now both those films are seen not only as some of the best sci-fi films ever made, the thing is seen as one of the best horror films ever made. And, you know, even as a kid, we knew what was up. You know, John Carpenter films were just, a lot of them were unappreciated at the time that they came out. And it seems like time has been so kind to his filmography. For whatever reason, he was either ahead of the curve or something about his work just didn't latch on until later for a lot of people. But for people of our generation, we were into it. And I think the special effects blow anything today away. Rob Bottin was just a mad genius. He kind of had slipped off the radar. I don't know whatever happened to him. He did a lot of great work. I think he did some work for Terminator 2, I think, if I'm correct. But he did some other work from other films, but his work on this is just a thing of beauty. The stuff he came up with is so ghastly and so weird, you know, like the head that turns into like a little, arachnid.
Tentacles.
Yeah. With like eyeballs that pop out. It's just, you know, there's all these great set pieces. There's a set piece with where they do a blood test to find out who's the thing, because the thing is, the thing takes over people's bodies. He makes perfect replicas of them, so you don't know who's human and who's the thing. And the whole thing is a guessing game of you know, paranoia. Carpenter has said that this was kind of coming out right at the time that AIDS was making a lot of some headway in the news, was picking up as a pandemic. And saying that kind of fed into that paranoia of you don't know what's in the blood. But there was just such paranoia. The performances are fantastic. Kurt Russell, of course, is magnetic as MacReady as the leader, but you've got Wilford Brimley, you've got Keith David, you've got so many great actors who are playing great character roles. It's a phenomenal film. I absolutely love it. They tried to do a remake of it, which was okay. It was like a prequel remake, weird kind of combination, but nothing is going to beat The Thing for me. It's the best. And I just bought it on 4K recently. I'm planning on watching it sometime this week for the first time on 4K. I'm excited about that. So yeah, The Thing, I can't talk about it enough. I've seen it probably more than any other film. I've watched it. And every time I see it, I see something new, and I like seeing it on repeated viewing because you start seeing certain actors playing parts before they're caught as the thing. You see them change their behavior, or you see them cooperating with each other when more than one person is the thing. You see them like interacting differently. So it's a fantastic film.
Yeah, the prequel wasn't bad. In fact, I initially recommended it. The only thing that did the film in were these awful CGI effects. And from what I read later, the director didn't want to use that. They actually wanted to do what Rob Bottin did, but the studio or someone didn't want to do it, so they put in these CGI effects. And they're so fake looking. I've always said this about CGI. If it looks fake, don't use it. And for our listeners out there, each manifestation of the thing is different. It's not like to say the creature doesn't look the same throughout. There are different variants of it. So it's not like one particular type of monster. It's all these different forms. And you mentioned about Blade Runner. Well, a lot of people blame, cause another alien film about an alien came out 2 weeks before. It was E.T. So while the world was enraptured by this kindly, friendly alien, 2 weeks later, there was the most nihilistic alien movie ever made.
Yeah.
So it didn't do the box office that Universal had hoped for, and it cost Carpenter the job of doing Firestarter from the Stephen King novel that he was supposed to do before. So, okay, that's The Thing. And next for you?
We're going to do another one that we both made our list, and that is, speaking of Steven Spielberg and E.T., we're going to go with Jaws. Jaws was his 1974, I believe. 75. It was his first major motion picture. It was based off the Peter Benchley book. It starred masterclass in casting with Rory Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, and why is his name escape me?
Robert Shaw
playing this trio that are trying to stop this great white shark, which is attacking people on this coastal town. It's infamous for having a robotic shark that didn't work. They nicknamed it
Bruce.
But you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and Spielberg, you know, specifically shot it showing the shark less and less because it just worked so poorly, but it actually played to the film's favor because it made it more terrifying, because it's what you don't see that's almost scarier than what you do see. And it's PG. It's a PG film, but it does have definite moments of violence and nudity. But this is back in the day where you could show nudity in a PG movie. But it's just a classic escapist adventure horror show that, you know, it still holds up. It's one of those near perfect films that it's just so entertaining and so suspenseful, and the character interplay is so wonderful. I mean, you have some bad cat. I mean, the woman playing the wife is pretty terrible. I don't know where they found her, but she is just.
She was married to one of the producers or something. She was married to someone. She was married to someone, because when they did Jaws 2, no, what was it? Jaws 2, the original director quit because he couldn't stand working with her, but she was in because of who she knew, and so he walked off the project. So go ahead.
Well, that explains a lot. But Richard Dreyfuss is great. Roy Scheider is great. Robert Shaw is fantastic. There's that scene where he gets the attention of everybody by scraping his nails on the chalkboard. It still makes my teeth ache every time I see it. You've got Murray Hamilton playing the town mayor, who is the ultimate shitheel. Just the most cringeworthy, cowardly. We got to keep the beaches open. We got to make money. Don't tell people there's a shark. They're going to scare away the tourism. He's a great villain in this. And then, of course, the shark is fantastic when it does work. It, you know, even though it was mechanically not working so well and it was in the 70s, it still looks, you know, sharks have a weird look to them. They look almost fake in real life. So it looks, to me, it looks effective when they do show it. And, you know, of course, the music from John Williams, a masterclass in minimalism, one of the most, you know, infamous and familiar film scores ever, along with another one that's going to be next up on my list. But yeah, Jaws. I mean, what else can you say? It's just a classic.
Spielberg's best. And from what I heard, yeah, about the shark not working, and they were shooting in the Atlantic Ocean, and the shooting conditions were terrible. And I've read where the editor, Verna Fields, people say, and I quote, saved Spielberg's bacon, because she rescued that film in the editing room. She did win the Oscar that year for Jaws. She's always one of our best editors. And what you don't see the shark until halfway through the movie, and a lot of people haven't seen it. If you've heard this line going around called "you're going to need a bigger boat," well, that's where this comes from, because you see it from mostly you see it from the shark's point of view when it's going after its prey. So you don't really know how big it is, and then you see how big it is, and you're like, wow. And of course, you know, I love the movie. Of course, the first thing I always say whenever I watch it, go, why the hell didn't they call the Coast Guard? That always goes in my head. Why the hell did they call the goddamn Coast Guard? You got three people going out on this boat after it. I'm like, what? And the characters are wonderful. Roy Scheider makes a very appealing everyman. You know, he's not some two-fisted, machoismo-fueled hero. That's the Robert Shaw character who's determined to get them all killed just so he can put another notch in his belt. Richard Dreyfuss provides the comic relief, but not obnoxiously so. You really saw his cracked comic timing. It is so much better than the book. The book, oh my gosh, it's just, the book's terrible. It has a subplot about the Richard Dreyfuss character and Brody's wife having an affair. There's a subplot about the mayor having mob connections and the community. It was just like, and the ending is totally different. In the ending, Brody just winds up killing it by repeatedly stabbing it with this pole. And Spielberg came up with a much better ending involving an oxygen tank. And eventually, he wrote the screenplay. He did the novel, but he also wrote the screenplay. Reportedly, he went to Spielberg when Spielberg came up with the idea, and Benji said, they will laugh you off the screen if you do that. Well, not so, because it's one of the great movie endings of all time. And Scheider's reaction when he sees that he's done pretty much the impossible, that laugh he gives, I just love that to death.
And also, there's the infamous scene where Shaw's character is talking about surviving the U.S. Indianapolis boat wreck of during World War II, where it's a true life story where a lot of the a lot of the people who got off the boat who were waiting for it to be rescued were picked off by sharks. A lot of them got killed, and it was written. I believe this dialogue was written by John Milius, and
it was
And it is. It's one of the great moments because it's not showing you anything. It's just strictly dialogue, but you really get a sense of being on that boat and trapped and getting picked off, and the terror that he recounts. It's just one of the great monologues of cinema history.
It's horrifying. Okay, next on my list. Now this is a remake. The original. This film, it came out in 1956. It was in black and white. Let's see, what is that? 22? No, let me do the math here. God, I hate when I can't do math. 23 years later, they remade it. It's called The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The black and white version was very good. It's about this alien species that comes to Earth in a form that we don't expect. It's not green men in flying saucers. It's actually this kind of plant that has somehow drifted from world to world. It survived entering Earth's atmosphere. And what it does is we were talking about the thing earlier. Well, this duplicates bodies too, only a little bit differently. They're called pods. And when someone falls asleep nearby a pod, the pod imitates, basically reproduces the person flawlessly. The original human dies off. It's just basically sucked out of any kind of organic matter. And the difference between the two is the alien reproduction has no emotions. It doesn't have anger. It doesn't have, it doesn't laugh. It's just basically non-emotional. And the total goal of the species is to infect everyone on Earth and make everybody the same. Now, a lot of people call it the original, had this, I read some film theory books, but I don't really get into film theory. I think a lot of it's preposterous crap, and they did say maybe it was a dig at McCarthyism back in the day, and the studio made them put this stupid FBI prologue and epilogue on there to give it a happy ending. The remake takes place in San Francisco. The original took place in a small town. This takes place in San Francisco, which is one of the has some of the most eccentric people of all time. It just wouldn't have been effective in some kind of nameless, something like Omaha or, Dubuque or something like that. The late critic Pauline Kael correctly noted that the theme of the film is striving to keep your eccentricity. There has been some subjects. Is the alien species evil? Because while it's killing the human soul, but it also gets it where there's no hate. So if there's no hate, there's probably going to be no war. And so you go, is it evil though? If it's evil, and I've gone back and forth on that, but then you go, yes, it is evil because it's basically destroying the person's soul, any sense where they can't love or have any sort of affection for anybody. And the cast is wonderful. Donald Sutherland headlines the cast. There's Jeff Goldblum. Leonard Nimoy did one of his huge non-Star Trek roles as this chick psychiatrist. Location shooting is great. It has got one of the great electronic scores of all time. It's just absolutely dazzling. It just got put on 4K by Kino Lorber. The lighting is just absolutely wonderful. And it's got the ending shot. The ending shot of the film will just stay in your nightmares forever. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah. And if I had to make a top 15 or a top 20, this definitely would have made my list. You're the first one that showed this to me. I remember seeing it when I was a little kid. It was on like ABC, like Sunday Night Movie or something like that. And I kind of saw bits and pieces, but I didn't see the whole thing. So years later, getting to see it from the beginning was awesome. It's one of those films, another film like Jaws, it was PG, but it still had some horrific imagery, especially when you see the people turning into pods. There's one scene where a pod gets destroyed that's particularly gruesome. But yeah, the cast is phenomenal. It's got some great nods to the original. There's some cameos from the original film in there that are expertly used. They're perfect. You know, not, you know, it's not like what you would call fan service. I don't think it really fits so perfectly into the film when you see a main character from the first film into this film. Expertly done. It's Philip Kaufman, who's a very quirky director. He's got some really odd choices. Like there's this, you know, one, they use bagpipes in this one scene for music, which gives this really ghostly, eerie quality. It's another film from the 70s, a PG film that has nudity in it and used in a very interesting way. I think that, it's great. It's great watching people when you see they've been taken over, just how their personality has been drained. Donald Sutherland is excellent. And it's got some really just nice character moments too. There's lots of humor in it, a lot of humor in it. From when he is a health inspector's restaurant to a scene where he's falling in love with his coworker, and she does this weird thing with her eyes. Just some nice, real nice touches. And Nimoy, of course, has this one shot that Jack and I always found unintentionally funny, which always, always.
He's locked in this. He's locked in this room, and you can see him through the glass in the window. Yeah, it still makes me crack up.
But it's really funny because I think the first film is kind of a commentary on like the Red Scare, you know, people being paranoid about, you know, Russian propaganda taking over. And this film is to me like more of a commentary on like kind of like the hippie generation having to grow up and become more of the yuppie variety. Also a lot of the self-help talk, which, you know, a lot of it was very helpful, but a lot of it was a lot of hooey. And it kind of plays into that, you know, the Bay, it takes place in San Francisco. So kind of the Bay Area, Hyde-Ashbury fallout, I think plays into some of the commentary, but yeah, great movie. Definitely would have made, if I made a longer list, it would have been up there. I owned it on Blu-ray. I'm planning on watching it sometime this month. So yeah. And I think it and The Thing would make a perfect double feature. If you're doing like a theme horror night, you can't get better than The Thing, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And it's also interesting in that both films are about, you know, aliens possessing human bodies, and both films are remakes, which is kind of unique.
Yeah, and the sequel, now the original's been remade three times. This one was the second one, 1993. It was called just Body Snatchers, directed by Abel Ferrara, this really controversial B-movie director, and it's a good film. It's set at a military base, which is interesting because, let's face it, military people are basically, they're very, you know, follow orders. They're taught to be a team, and so they're a little bit, it's a little bit harder to see who, to suspect who's taken over, because they're basically the same, you know, military and the alien species is all about unity. It's very colorfully shot. Unfortunately, I hear the studio cut like 20 minutes out of it. And we said this before, Michael, I can't think of a single time where a studio took over a film post-production and it wound up better.
Yeah.
And the other one was called The Invasion with Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig. It was set in the UK. Not a bad picture, but it was too, it kind of antiseptic. It didn't really have any primal terror. So Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And next up for you?
Next up for me is one of the most controversial horror films, but also one of the most classic. And that is the original Exorcist, William Friedkin's adaptation of the William Peter Blatty novel. It came out in 1973, and it was one of those films, going back to Psycho was kind of, Hitchcock expertly marketed that film by saying, you might need to see a doctor before going to the theater. You'll get your money back if you survive the film. It just really kind of overplaying it. But The Exorcist actually had instances of people passing out in the film, vomiting during the film. People were just not prepared for this movie when it came out. It's a tale of demonic possession, of course. It stars Linda Blair as this angelic little girl who turns into this foul-mouthed, you know, demon. William Friedkin who recently passed away. We recently did a podcast episode dedicated to him. He has this kind of documentarian guerrilla style of filmmaking, and he really put the cast through the ringer. You know, Ellen Burstyn, who was fantastic as her mom, and Max von Sydow as a priest. Jason, what's his name? The other priest,
Jason Miller.
Jason Miller. Go ahead.
No, Jason Miller and Max von Sydow were the priests.
Yeah, and it's an interesting film because it takes a long time to kind of get to the point, basically. But it all really adds up this interesting tapestry. Like, there's this early scene, opening of the film, where you see the original priest, played by Max von Sydow, who's kind of going archaeology dig in Iraq, and he finds this strange sculpture that looks demonic. It somehow plays into it later. You've got this wonderful scenes of this mother and daughter together, and eventually turns tragic when she gets, you know, possessed, and she's taken to all these psychiatric, you know, meetings and to like ER for this horrible procedure that is just traumatizing her. But it feels almost like a documentary. Like, it feels like you're seeing that real life family just being split apart by this you know, demonic invasion. It's got a terrifying dream sequence with Jason Miller's dreaming about his mother. And then there's this split second shot of this demonic face that was used in the trailer much more explicitly. I actually recently bought a t-shirt a few weeks ago that's got that face on it. I felt like I really scored something amazing. Very proud of myself for finding this. Imagery like that is so effective. And of course it has like the vomiting, and it's got one of the most controversial scenes ever involving Reagan, the daughter, in a crucifix, which I won't go into more detail on that, but it was still, even today, it still really packs a punch. And, you know, it's amazing. I'm looking at it on Rotten Tomatoes now, and the score is only 78% for The Exorcist. A lot of negative reviews came out when it first came out. And I think even some revisionist reviews are saying that it's not all this crack up to be, but I wholeheartedly disagree. I think it's one of the few films that really did truly terrify me to the point where I had nightmares about it. And, I think it's fantastic. You know, they recently did a sequel to it, which is getting horrifically bad reviews. It looks truly, truly terrible. I mean, I'm going to watch it when it comes out to see how bad it is, but it looks bad, bad, bad. Somehow they got Ellen Burstyn to come back, but The Exorcist is one of those films that has never had a great sequel, except for the third film, which isn't great, but it's got some really cool parts to it. So I cautiously recommend Exorcist 3, but all the other sequels have been garbage. And you can't beat the original. It's still shocking. It's still creepy. It's still very dramatic. And it's just a great slice of cinema that you know still holds up.
Yeah, 73. I mean, this is a big deal back in 73. Some argued it should have gotten an X rating. I mean, if it had been a major studio who put it out, it would have got rated X. There's no doubt in my mind, but a minor studio wouldn't have had the budget to make the film. So, and it spawned all these awful demonic possession movies, mostly from Italy. Italy wound up actually doing the most ripoffs of them, and most of them are just absolutely terrible. I heard Friedkin was a perfectionist. He actually had the house rebuilt, this Georgetown townhouse or whatever. He was so picky about the look, he actually had it torn down, and they built another one. He was the cast is really wonderful in the picture. I especially like Jason Miller. I think he makes a wonderful hero. The film's a little you're right, it kind of does take a while to get going, because you never quite figure out it opens in Iraq. It is Iraq. You never quite figure how this thing got this statuette or whatever got from there to this Georgetown penthouse. So it's a little clunky from there. But then again, the novel wasn't any great shakes either. The movie is greatly improved upon it. Yeah, it's a scary picture. I don't know if kids today watching it would really affect them, because they've become inured to a lot of, you know, crappy horror pictures and stuff of this variation. But back then, it definitely made an impression. We mentioned during the Freakin' In podcast that I told you to this day, adjusted for inflation, it is still the highest grossing horror movie of all time, and adjusted for inflation, it's the highest grossing picture Warner Brothers has ever made. So, which is an accomplishment, because this was rated R, and this wasn't some PG-13 movie where you had teenagers munching popcorn and going to the movie. This was an R-rated feature. So the fact that it was so high grossing for an R-rated film, I think that's saying something. It tells you just how many people flocked. I mean, New York and Times Square, lines were wrapped around the building to see this film, much like, you know, some important film. So that's definitely, and it got a recent 4K release. So apparently, from what I've read, it looks better than it ever has. Yeah, stay away from the sequel, except Exorcist 3 does have its things, but otherwise, stick with the original. Let's see, next on my list, and I've got two left, mine is Dawn of the Dead. And you millennials out there, do not think this is the crappy 2004 remake. It is not. It's the original that came out in 1978. It's by George A. Romero. He wrote and directed it, just like he wrote and directed the original. It's called Night of the Living Dead from 1968, a black and white horror picture about zombies trapping some humans in an isolated farmhouse. They crave flesh. If they bite someone, that person is then taken over, and he or she becomes a zombie. What makes the difference here in this film is that rather an isolated farmhouse, it takes place mainly in a shopping mall, a big shopping mall in Pennsylvania. Now, this was in 78, before malls were that big of a thing. So back then, a mall was a very unique setting. There's four humans. They managed to escape Pittsburgh in a helicopter. They come across this mall. They sit down. They figure, okay, we'll get some, you know, rest for a while, maybe find some food. And the mall is overrun by zombies, but they're slow-moving zombies. They're not fast-moving. They're slow-moving. The only way to kill one is to shoot it in the head. But they get in this mall, and they go, wait a minute, we have a good thing going here. So they wind up killing, they shoot all the zombies, they put them in this big old freezer, so they don't stick up the place. They get these semi-trucks, and they block all the entrances to the mall. And so while there's zombies outside the mall, they can't get in, and these four have a run of a shopping mall to themselves. They get to go to the bank and take out all this money. They've got all these restaurants. They've got all these places like JCPenney's to get clothing. Well, back then was high dollar clothing. There's even a gun store. How about that, Michael? A gun store in a mall.
Yeah.
Only back in 78 and they have any kind of weapon known to man aside from rocket launchers in there, and they form an existence over in there. It's almost 2.5 hours long, and yet there's not a scene that's wasted. Romero not only wrote and directed, he edited it. And the craftsmanship is just incredible, because you could look at it and say, you know, this is going to get old after a while. They're stuck in one setting, but this mall is pretty big. There's all these different stores, and one of the humans does wind up getting killed. I always say that this Romero was making a statement on machismo, because the ones who wind up getting killed are largely people who think they take absurd chances around these slow-moving zombies, and it turns out, well, that's not going to cut it, because they wind up doomed because of it. The four characters are very believable. That they're unknown actors at the time. They're solid. There's a great cameo by Tom Savini. He did this outlandish special effects, and he plays this biker motorcycle biker who you think he has a knife, a switchblade. It turns out he flicks it and it's the comb and he combs his mustache. So there's some humor into the film too. It's definitely one of the most, it's the most horrifying straight horror picture ever made. I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah. Dawn of the Dead, definitely one that I would have put on a longer list. I had trouble though, trying to decide if I like that or Night of the Living Dead more. I probably lean more towards Night of the Living Dead just because it came first and which is so influential. But I think what George Romero has done in all of his zombie films is that each of the films has a definite specific tone and differentiate enough that they really feel like, you know, like separate pieces of a whole. But yeah, as far as a consumer culture, commentary and dark comedy, but also some great gore effects and some, you know, some great jolts. It's just, you know, it's just a great indie horror film. And, I think that, I actually don't dislike the remake like you do. I found it entertaining enough, but yeah, definitely the original is of course by far the best. And George Romero is really the godfather of the zombie film, movement. I mean, there's been so many films that have come in its place, but you know, his stuff is still the you know, the pinnacle, I think, of zombie filmmaking. So yeah, definitely a great film. I think all the Living Dead films deserve some attention, but the first two are definitely my favorites for sure.
Well, Romero takes there's some slight social satire in there about consumerism, where one of the humans said, when they've got all the zombies out and they've got them all to themselves, but they can still hear the zombies trying to get in the outside. And the woman says, why do they keep coming here? And I think it's one who plays the pilot says, this used to be an important part of their lives. So there's some satire on consumerism, but it's not overdone. There was a critic I'm friends with. He thought it was overdone. I said, no, it's not overdone. I thought it's very understated. And I mean, my gosh, it exploits something that almost everyone has fantasized about. What if you had an entire shopping mall to yourself, access to every store, access to everything in the thing? That to this day to me is it's a great idea. And so every time I watch and I'm always go, God, I wish I could be there. Oh, I wish I could have, you know, heck, they even get free arcade games. Yeah, you and me would have loved that when we were teenagers and an arcade to ourselves where we didn't have to pay for anything. So that's my pick. The sequel, there is a sequel called Day of the Dead. It's not bad, but it's way too talky. It takes place in this underground bunker. Apparently, Romero, he wrote, directed it. Apparently, his budget got cut by a third, and they couldn't do the script he wanted to. So it's great at the end when you get all the bloody decapitations and stuff. But up until then, the acting is absolutely horrendous. People shout and yell, and it's just way too talky. It's like, what, as one critic said, it's basically a movie about characters seeing how trying to talk themselves to death. So there's that. So next on your list?
Next on my list, we're going to another John Carpenter film, and that is the original 1978 Halloween. That was John Carpenter's first major hit. He had previously made Dark Star, a college film that became a theatrical release, and then he went with Assault on Precinct 13, which is a really, really cool little crime thriller that I recommend. But Halloween was the, you know, you had Psycho and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but Halloween was really the film that started the whole slasher movement that had endless copycats like Friday the 13th and so many films that borrow from it, but nothing to me tops the original. Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like Psycho, Halloween is not a bloody movie. It's got a few scenes where you see a little blood, but it's very, very minimal. It's, you know, it launched the character Michael Myers, which is just one of the all-time great horror villains. You know, he wears that mask. It gives him no personality. That mask that they found from a William Shatner mold of his face, and somehow they spray painted it white, messed up the hair, and somehow it just took on this otherworldly quality. It was Jamie Lee Curtis's first big break. John Carpenter cast her, one, because she was great in it, but two, because she was the daughter of Janet Lee and Tony Curtis, and he thought that would give him some notoriety since she was, you know, the daughter of the Scream Queen from Psycho. And so it's a very simple story about a, you know, a maniacal killer who escapes from a mental ward and goes after her and her friends. It really started the whole teen slasher film where, you know, the kids go have sex, they get killed, but the kid that's, you know, more morally upright or prudish, is more aware of her surroundings. She's not distracted by the alcohol and the sex, so she's able to evade the killer. It's got one of the all-time great horror soundtracks ever. I mean, everybody knows the theme. It's been remade, you know, relentlessly, endless sequels, but none of them have the power of the original. I do like Halloween Part 2 and Halloween 3, though, in particular. I think those are two really good sequels. But the first one, it's just got a unique quality to it. The cinematography from Dean Cundey is just so evocative and moody. And it's just a really masterclass in how to make a low budget, very low budget film and up its value by using the camera work and the score. And it, for many years until the Blair Witch Project, it was the highest grossing independent film of all time. And, yeah, so Halloween, it's, you know, it's a classic for a reason, and it's the perfect Halloween film to watch on Halloween.
You know, it's scary. Carpenter sustains an eerie mood from first frame to last. Even the simple scene where the killer winds up escaping and taking over that station wagon. That right there is that shot of him when we see him for the first time on top of that car scares the bejesus out of me. So, the other thing, what really helps the film, you mentioned Jamie Lee Curtis. Well, Donald Pleasance,
yes,
has top billing. He was paid $10,000 a day. Which back then was a pretty amount of money, and he sustains the movie. He plays Dr. Loomis, who the killer was his patient. Well, the patient was his patient for what, 15 years? Because as a little boy, he slaughtered his sister, stabbed her to death, and since then hadn't spoken a word. He continually told his staff this: he is evil to the nth degree. There's no, you know, don't ever let him out. And so he tries to help the police in finding the killer. And Pleasance is solid throughout. He doesn't treat it like it's a horror film. He treats it very realistically. And he's carrying around that 44 Magnum. So he's, I don't know how a psychiatrist shoots so well, but he does. He, right. It takes place in a place called a small town called Haddonfield in Illinois, but they actually filmed it in a neighborhood in Los Angeles, I remember. And Dean Cundey does a wonderful job of shooting it, the lighting. It was shot this was the first film the Carpenter shot in widescreen, and he's great with a 2.35:1 frame. There's a lot of subjective camera work where sometimes you're not sure if it's the killer, if it's one of the teenagers or if it's the killer. I remember one critic, I think it was Pauline Kael, wrote, and this is a thing, she said, there's so much subjective camera work, you're convinced every character has their own camera. But I mean, that's fine because it's a limited setting. It's just in this neighborhood, and Carpenter keeps it visually alive throughout. It's beautiful to look at. Like I said, the score is there. And there's very little blood at all. I think the most violence that we see comes at the, there's that discovered body of the owner of that pickup truck. I think just that shot there has more, you know, violence than anything else in the picture. So, if you're looking for, you see all these slasher pictures of the 80s, you want to know what spawned them, it's John Carpenter's Halloween. So the screenplay is pretty much bare bones, and I think that's complimentary to Carpenter. They managed to make something so involving being that it's nothing complex. It's not trying to say anything. It just wants to scare the bejesus out of you, and it does. Highly recommended. Now, my number one film on my list, and Michael has it on his list too, my favorite horror film of all time. It came out in 1979, 1 year later than Halloween. It is the original Alien by director Ridley Scott. This was only his second feature. His first feature was this historic drama called The Duelist, very beautifully made, and there were a lot of directors who they were considered, but the producers didn't really want him because they didn't seem to be taking the material seriously. And it went to Ridley Scott. What this movie basically is about is a intergalactic freighter. This, of course, takes place in the future. And they're returning to Earth after mining 20 million pounds of ore. And they're halfway home and they get wakened out of their sleep chambers by the ship's computer has told them that it's picking up a signal from a distant planetoid. Not even a planetoid. Well, three of the people go onto the planet. They find this really bizarre-looking alien ship. They enter it. They send one person down, finds out there's a whole holding cargo of these egg-like things. One of them gets infected. They bring him back on board. There's like a crab thing over his face. They can't get it off. They think taking it off would kill him. Turns out the thing winds up just coming off his face. The astronaut, he thinks he's normal, but then during dinner they find out that the alien is still with them. I don't want to give away too much, but basically it starts out as a baby alien, and then as the film occurs, it grows basically into an 8-foot virtually indestructible creature with acid-like substance for blood. The crew has limited weapons. The most they've got are flamethrowers, and so they try to get rid of this creature, but it's highly intelligent. This is a ship that doesn't look like one out of Star Wars. It's very rustic. It's very lived in. It doesn't have gleaming white walls or anything like that. And one of the films, every time I watch this, I know exactly every shot, every scene, and yet from the beginning, whenever I put the movie on, I'm enveloped. A good part of that is Jerry Goldsmith's wonderful score, but Ridley Scott, like I said, this is only his second film, and you're trapped on this spaceship just like the characters are, and you're just held helpless because one by one, this highly hostile organism is determined to wipe them all out. It does have some logic loopholes, which is inherent basically of almost all sci-fi movies, and it has a really great conclusion where Sigourney Weaver's Ripley, this was only her second film, and she plays the heroine. The film really did, so you were talking earlier about, how Psycho gets rid of its main character early. Well, according to the credits, you see Tom Skerritt, he plays the captain, you figure he's going to be the hero. No, he winds up getting killed he's one of the first humans to get killed. And so Sigourney Weaver's third officer takes over. And that was original at the time. The character was written basically to be a man, but Ridley Scott said, hey, let's make it a woman. And this was before CGI was there. That's Alien still holds up today. The shots of the spaceship, the creature, all of that is organically done. There's no computer-generated effects, and even watching it on 4K, which improves the resolution, I don't see anything that looks fake. About the only thing I could probably pick is, there is this wonderful scene where they try to get the creature off. They wind up cutting it, one of the fingers. This is when it's still attached to Kane's head, and it unleashes this yellow-like substance, just winds up eating through two layers of the ship. And once that happens, the crew is like, we're in trouble. We're in deep trouble. One other thing, the reason it's a very disturbing depiction of corporate greed, because basically the corporation has sent them on their mission. They've basically they want the alien for their weapons division, and it's ensure the return of the specimen, first priority, crew expendable. So it's a brilliant picture. My only regret, Michael, I've never seen it on the big screen. I've never seen it. I really wish I could have came out in 79. So it started, and this is another film that when it hit Laserdisc was a revelation, because it was letterboxed. I was seeing all this information on the sides I'd never seen before. So that's my number one horror film of all time. It's horror slash sci-fi. And you're talking about a scene that sends people reeling. I don't want to give anything away for people who haven't seen it, but there's a dinner time scene that has a real it has a real visual payoff. It did have people throwing up in the theaters. It's a solid picture. The alien is Alien was designed by H.R. Giger, a Swiss artist, very demented man, and they were all wondering, what is this creature going to look like? They didn't want it to look like a man in a rubber suit, and Scott shot it very well, where you just get glimpses of the creature. You don't really see it in its final form, full out until the very end. So it really stirs the imagination when you don't quite know what the alien looks like. Then when you see it in its full-blown glory, it's horrifying. So my number one horror film of all time, Alien.
Yeah, and there's a really great, on the Blu-ray and the 4K, there's a really great documentary about the making of the film, and they talk about how H.R. Giger Giger, however it's pronounced, would build these elaborate sets, of course, that from like the planetary they land onto, and then Ron Cobb developed the ship. And everybody in the set, so they really felt like they were in that world. It really helped them get into character. And of course, Giger's alien was so weird. Like, it's this kind of sexual, like the head looks like a penis, and like it's got this very like unsettling sexual connotations to it. They really designed the one integral scene as a sexual assault. I mean, that was like, Dan O'Bannon, who also wrote Dead and Buried and directed it, or not direct, wrote it. When he wrote this film, it was basically like a serious version of Dark Star, which is that film they had written with John Carpenter. And he really thought that making a male rape scene in a way would really freak audiences out, because it just hadn't, besides Deliverance, it really hadn't been explored, especially not the way they did it here. Very, very different. And it really just unsettles you and makes you realize that anything is possible in this film. Like you mentioned, the corporate greed angle was really ahead of its time. It really was before we had all this, downsizing and sending jobs overseas and all that. It really kind of hinted at that kind of hollow culture. And it also spawned one of the greatest sequels to a film ever, Aliens, which managed to be different enough to really separate it from the original. Basically the first film was a horror film. The second film was an action film. They're both great. I still think the first one's the best, especially visually. And of course, they've made sequels ever since that have been a varying quality, but nothing tops the first two and nothing tops the first one. I mean, it's visually, it really is just an amazing film, and showed Ridley Scott, become one of the great filmmakers. Alien, Alien and The Thing are the two best sci-fi horror films of all time. I give it to The Thing because it's just my personal favorite, but Alien is a very close second, and no problem having it being your top pick. It's definitely a great one.
All right. Well, great. Well, that wraps up that time. One more thing about Alien. It cost less than $9 million. You look back at look at this production. It's amazing. I heard Ridley Scott was doing like 34. He was doing like 30, 40 takes, not takes. He was doing 30, 40 setups a day. So they were 20th Century Fox. Really, they were a bunch of money grubbers. They kept saying, shoot faster, shoot faster. And And he did it. And he also operated the camera. That's not really done anymore, where inspected the cinematographer does it. And Scott was actually not he directed, but he operated the camera. He wanted to be in there with the shot. This was Sigourney Weaver's second film. Her only other one was A Walk on an Annie Hall, but she was a stage actress, but she was new to the camera. And I read this where she said when she first started out on the film, really had to keep telling her, don't look into the camera. So one more thing about the sequels. They're all crap. I will put in a word for 1997's Alien Resurrection. It's a widely misunderstood film. It's a black comedy first, a horror movie second. So I do like that one a lot. So, all right. You have a couple of runner-ups for your top 10.
Yeah, I wanted to give a shout-out. I forgot to mention The Shining. I mean, The Shining to me is one of those films that is seminal, so you have to have that somewhere on the list, whether you are a huge fan or not. You can't diminish the impact, even though Stephen King doesn't like it. But I'm also a real fan of the Japanese film House, which is a really strange horror comedy thing. It's not exactly what I would call scary, but it's one of those films, like a fever dream kind of film, that you've never seen anything like it. If you like foreign films, if you like really quirky films, definitely check it out. And then there is a film called Green Room that came out a few years ago. That's about this hardcore punk band that gets stuck in this skinhead club and have to fight their way to get out, which is one of the most amazing suspenseful films of the past few years. I really, really love it, and it's got some great practical gore effects. Highly recommend it. It didn't get a lot of love when it came out just because it's a strange subject matter for a picture, but that's also what makes it so cool. It's just very original, and yeah, so Green Room. Definitely give that a shot. Think of anything else that's on top of my tongue. I'm sure I'm going to forget. There's so many great horror films out there. I mean, Phantasm is just a really goofy film, but I enjoy it all the more. I watch it every October. Not a great film, but it's so weird. You have to give it some love. Yeah. So those are some that I'll give a little shout out to.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of The Shining, but I still. And it's still interesting to watch because Kubrick does get some very good mood and atmosphere with it. And it's just such a fantastic setting. It's kind of like Dawn of the Dead. You know, Dawn of the Dead, you've got this whole shopping mall. Well, they've got the three-member family's got this entire gigantic hotel all to themselves with this kitchen that's the size of a football stadium. So that's kind of cool. I mean, that's kind of cool, too. Hey, I've got this whole hotel to myself. So let's see. My runner-ups, I've got a few. There's 1980s. It's called Alligator, about a giant alligator terrorizing a metropolitan city. It's the film where Quentin Tarantino decided to cast Robert Forster in his Jackie Brown because Forster played the hero of this film, a cop. He's very believable. It's a low budget, but the special effects are wonderful. And the direction by Louis Teague is first rate. It's an involving picture. Event Horizon from 1997. That's a sci-fi horror film, the best sci-fi horror film since the original Alien. Top marks there. And the original Nightmare on Elm Street that came out in 1984. I saw that opening day with my dad in a very small theater. It felt very enclosed. The picture scared the hell out of me. It's a very good picture. Please, our listeners, this is the 84 version, not the remake. Skip it. And finally, you see there's Session 9, which takes place in this abandoned four-story former psychiatric facility. It's a very unnerving picture. And I will throw in for Halloween 3. That's one of my favorites, too. It's not like the other Halloween films. It doesn't have Michael Myers. I've probably heard it at the box office, but it's a very original, very colorful, very energetic picture. And you're right. After we hang up, after we get through the podcast, we're going to have a million films coming to our go. Oh, why didn't I say anything about that one or that one? Well, you know, hey, we're human. We can't remember. We can't have everything come to mind.
That's right. We definitely pick some highlights. And if you're looking for some stuff to augment your Halloween viewing and you haven't seen any of these, in the unlikely event you haven't seen all of these, definitely check them out. There's some you like more than others, but they're all classics for a reason. And yeah, give them a watch. This is the time to do it. spooky season demands watching horror films, and these are some of the best you're going to see.
Yeah, the only one, I was surprised, Session 9 is the only one from the 2000s I have on my list, and Event Horizon was 1997. I didn't like it when I first saw it. I thought the special effect, I thought it was more about special effects. Then I gave it another watch and just scared the piss out of me, especially that scene with the where Kathleen Quinlan hallucinates that her little girl is running across this hallway when, of course, they're on this spaceship and she's back. Oh, that just almost stops my heart right there. So that is definitely improved. And most of these films are available on Blu-ray and 4K, so you don't have to, unlike us, you don't have to settle for a cropped VHS that was either cropped or panned and scanned. You get to see it in its their original aspect ratio. So that's another thing the younger generation gets to do that we didn't. So, yeah, this was great, Michael. Thank you for having me. And I did pull up my top 10 list. I did change it around a little. I did have some things, but I'd say Alien and Dawn of the Dead have always been number one and number two.
Those are some great ones, and you can't go wrong with The Thing or in Halloween. So if you only could pick two from my list, those are the two I'd recommend. John Carpenter, all the way, my favorite film director. So yeah, let's do this again soon. We'll work on some other film lists, and always good to talk to you, Jack. And we'll do this again soon.
All right, good talking to you, and have a good one.
You too. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.